ever since I could speak and read, I've been fascinated with language, especially with how the meanings or connotations of words can change over time and how they can sometimes go from having a positive to a negative shade of meaning. The word enable or enabler is a case in point. As I first understood the term, you enabled someone by supporting them or by giving them the tools to accomplish something on their own that they might not otherwise be able to do or have someone else to do for them. If, say, you wanted to build a birdhouse, and I knew how to do that, and you asked for my help, instead of building the birdhouse for you, I would teach you how to build one and perhaps give you the boards and the tools and the equipment that you would need, and then you'd be on your own. I would be an enabler, in other words, for you to build a birdhouse, and that would be a good thing. However, as the language of the recovery movement with its 12-step process for overcoming addictions to alcohol or drugs or excessive eating or various other things like that, as that has gained increased currency, the language of that movement has gained increased currency, being an enabler has become a not-so-good thing. Now, an enabler is a person who helps or allows someone to perpetuate a harmful or destructive addiction, or who fails to confront someone else's destructive behavior. An enabler, in its more present usage, is someone who allows a person they're supposed to love and care about to keep doing harm to themselves, and that's a bad thing. I don't decry that shift so much as I see it as one of any number of examples I could cite of what a very fluid thing language really is, how language is not static at all. Well, a similar kind of thing has happened with the word tolerance, or tolerate. To be tolerant of opinions or points of view or ways of looking at the world that are different from your own, in its very best sense, that means to show respect for those opinions and viewpoints. It means to be open to learning more about them while still bringing your own views and opinions to the table. And that is all well and good. But we seem to have had a shift in our cultural lexicon here as well, in that tolerate has now come to mean, you know, barely put up with. We've come to use the term to point to our limits rather than our openness, as in that's about as much out of view as I am willing to tolerate. Probably used that myself a few times in my child-rearing days, as a matter of fact. Tolerance, then, has become what the late and still by me missed and lamented George Carlin liked to call a two-way word. Of course, now Carlin's two-way words, as those of you who followed his career and were into his stuff well know, they were usually ones that were regarded as perfectly acceptable in one context, but were considered crude, rude, or even obscene in another context, same word both times. I won't go into examples, but if you've heard any of his old routines, you know what he was talking about. That's not exactly the case with the word tolerance, but in a larger sense, a similar kind of thing goes on with it. Positive in one use, negative in another. So what I want to do with you for a time this morning is explore this notion of tolerance as a two-way word. And I especially want to look at how appeals to tolerance in some cases are really masks or shields for perpetuating certain forms of intolerance. But since I'm an accentuate the positive kind of a guy, I'm going to start with the positive, and I'm going to briefly dip in the next few minutes into our Unitarian Universalist history. So just working a little history lesson at the beginning before I get to the other piece of this. It was a spirit of affirmation and tolerance that first allowed what we now call Unitary Universalism to get a foothold in the religious landscape of 16th century Europe. Well, actually, it was an act of ultimate intolerance on the part of John Calvin that gave us our first Unitarian martyr in the person of Michael Servetus. Mr. Servetus, as many of you know, was burned at the stake in 1553 in the streets of Geneva, Switzerland, at Mr. Calvin's behest for questioning the doctrine of the Trinity. The interesting thing about that is that Geneva was supposed to be a stronghold and a symbol of the new light of the Protestant Reformation. But it didn't show a whole lot of enlightenment or tolerance towards poor Mr. Servetus. In the wake of Servetus' execution, however, I guess you could call it a positive backlash set in. The backlash was to such severe forms of religious persecution, and that began to take place in certain parts of Europe, most notably in the Kingdom of Transylvania, which covered parts of today's Romania and Hungary. 8 years after the death of Servetus, in 1561, a young prince of Transylvania named John Sigismund became the king of that land. He was, as best we can tell, the first and only Unitarian king in history. He was greatly influenced by his court preacher, the one Francis David, who was also of Unitarian persuasion. But rather than make 16th century Unitarianism the law of his land, the king issued instead, in 1568, the first Edict of Religious Toleration in Europe, also called the Edict of Tortoise, since that was where the capital of the kingdom was. It said in part, "The preacher should everywhere preach the gospel according to his own belief, and the community might accept it or not. Nobody should compel it, as this would not ease anybody's soul. Nobody is allowed to threaten anybody with prison or with expelling him from his place of teaching." Now that all may sound rather quaint, living as we do in a 21st century civil democracy, but in its day it was a truly radical document. In that day, the religion of the monarch was almost always regarded as the official religion of the land, and those who were at variance with it were often subject to persecution and sometimes even death. So during the reign of John Sigismund, Transylvania was, as you might call it, a religious free zone where a variety of faiths or no faith at all could be observed and practiced. Some of the Unitarian churches that were established in the wake of the Edict of Toleration are still in existence, and they're still in operation in certain villages in Hungary and Romania. It's a tribute to their amazing resilience that they have lasted over 400 years, and especially that they survived 50 years of communist domination in those countries from the end of the Second World War until the early 1990s. While the theology of these Hungarian and Romanian Unitarian churches is considerably more theistic and much more Christian-based than what you find in most American UU churches, they represent the earliest stages in the history of our liberal faith and in the tradition of religious toleration. So it was this principle of religious tolerance then that went a long way in giving birth to the liberal religious faith we practice right here today. It is a principle that holds that absolute truth cannot be fully known by human beings, that there is always more truth to be revealed and discovered, and therefore no religion can rightly lay claim to being the one and only absolutely right and true one. This same principle, by the way, is basic to modern science. Namely, that we act on what we know with the understanding that there will always be more truths to be discovered. Of course, we as individuals and as members or friends of a congregation like this one need to always be seeking out and living out with passion and conviction the truths we come to. But we do not insist that these truths are once and for all final, and nor do we categorically exclude the truths that others have found. That is what religious tolerance at its best is. I say all of that to end up by saying we should not then be dismissive of tolerance, since it made us what we are today as a liberal religious body. Well, that's my positive take on tolerance. I said it's a two-way word. For the place where this matter of tolerance and intolerance gets tricky are those times when appeals to tolerance are really masks or shields, as I see it, for certain kinds of intolerance. And many of those places are at that bedeviling intersection where the working of religion and the workings of the state or government intersect, as they so often do in the society and the culture in which we live. There are any number of examples I could use to expand upon this, but I'm going to limit it to two. It nearly slipped off my radar screen, but this past Thursday, February the 12th, was not only the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln, but it was also the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. I don't know if there's any kind of karmic significance or not to the fact that Abe Lincoln and Charles Darwin were born on the same day. I'm going to leave each of you to your own truth on that one. A number of my UU ministerial colleagues are doing Darwin evolution sermons today, so I figure I should at least give the man and his theory a nod while examining this bigger question of what constitutes tolerance and intolerance. Mr. Darwin may have been born 2 centuries ago and was something of a religious man in his own right. But his theory or principle of evolution, human or otherwise, still elicits calls to arms from certain quarters of the religious right. The argument from these quarters is that unless, in state-supported schools, some form of creationism isn't offered as an alternative to Darwin's theory of evolution, as is understood today, then the government is being intolerant and discriminatory towards those religious conservatives who reject Darwinism. The latest variation on what has been called, what was called scientific creationism, is now referred to as intelligent design. Unless then, so this argument goes, the principle of intelligent design, unless it is offered in science textbooks as an alternative explanation as to how and why we have the life forms that populate the earth at this time, then school boards are guilty of intolerance. Okay, let me take my shot at untangling this one. Intelligent design, to boil it down, is the idea that there had to be and still is some form or force or principle or being of intelligent, of deliberate intelligence behind the creation and the workings of the universe in order for it to operate according to the laws by which it operates, or the laws we've been able to discern this, at this point. Now, personally, I don't buy that idea any more than I buy the idea that there's some kind of cosmic significance about Lincoln and Darwin being born on the same day. Their parents conceived them, their mothers had them, and that was that. The meanings of their lives were not the date of their birth, but what they did with their lives once they were born and had them. Well, back to the point before I lose it. As a philosophical or theological question, I think the idea of intelligent design is one worthy of study and debate. In other words, tolerable in the good sense. Worthy and study of debate, that is to say, in a philosophy or a religious studies class. After all, I've made a career out of exploring religious and philosophical ideas and beliefs and deciding which ones resonate with me and which ones don't. And I do it all in a spirit of tolerance. So fine, let's discuss the idea of intelligent design in an academic setting. It is where you hold that discussion in an academic setting, however, that is the crux of the matter for me. My resistance to the teaching of intelligent design or creationism or whatever other term might be used, and if some folks wish to call this intolerance on my part, then I can't stop them, but it comes when evolution and intelligent design are asked or mandated to be presented as either or alternatives in a science class or textbook, as though it has to be one or the other. That route very quickly gets you back to the notion that there's only one kind of truth. And I take that to be, well, rather intolerant. In the world in which I live, and I feel this holds for most of us, both within and beyond this congregation, there are many truths, many types of truth. There is the truth of science. There's the truth of poetry. The truth of art. Truth of philosophy. Truth of religion. All of these truths and more inform and enhance the meanings of our lives. Intolerance, as I see it, is the insistence that the truth of any one of these realms automatically trumps or negates all the others. And I can't tolerate that kind of approach or attitude. Moving to my second example about tolerance and intolerance. In addition to being in the wake of Darwin's 200th anniversary, this week has also been designated as National Freedom to Marry Week by a coalition of liberal religious organizations, including our Unitarian Universalist Association, which together constitute the National Freedom to Marry Coalition. More details about the efforts and some of the things that are happening around the country this week are on the website of our UUA, so I refer you to that. Last November 4th, even as they candidly gave Barack Obama its electoral votes for president, the voters in the state of California also approved a ballot initiative called Proposition 8. Proposition 8 overturned a ruling by the California Supreme Court that granted marriage rights to same-sex couples. This referendum and proposition held that marriage in California could only be between an adult man and woman. The constitutionality of this referendum itself has now become yet another legal matter. The final outcome is still to be determined. The driving force behind the yes votes for this initiative, successful yes votes, came from a lot of the resources from the Mormon Church in next door state Utah, as well as in California, and from a strong evangelical population within that state, most certainly including the Reverend Warren's 20,000-member Saddleback megachurch in Los Angeles. One of the arguments put forward by these folk, and by the Reverend Warren in particular, was that they were the ones who were really the victims of intolerance and bigotry because they were being forced, quote-unquote, to accept a mode of marriage that ran contrary to their religious beliefs. This was why I was less than enthusiastic about Reverend Warren giving the invocation at the presidential inaugural, but I decided to invoke my spirit of tolerance and let it go. Okay, it's sort out time again. The kind of argument that Reverend Warren and others have put forward is really one for which the term disingenuous was coined. It's also a variation on the very same argument I heard put forth 40 years ago during the Civil Rights Movement when legislation to desegregate public facilities like restaurants, swimming pools, and the like was being proposed and voted on. There were some white folks then who said it was really their rights that were being violated because they did not want to be, quote unquote, forced to be near black people in public places. And what I hear now from those who resist the civil right to marry by gay and lesbian people is really one more verse of the same song. The extending of certain rights to a group that has previously been denied them doesn't take anything away from anybody when it comes to the workings of civil law. Back to the issue at hand, any religious body that feels that two adults of the same sex should not marry is perfectly free to take that position with its members and counsel them against such marriage or unions. I tolerate and respect their right to do that, even if I do not accept their position. And I fully agree that no member of the clergy, myself included, should have to officiate a marriage that he or she feels they cannot, in good faith and conscience, perform. Now that has always been the case, by the way. No state has ever required a minister to officiate a wedding that he or she does not wish to do. The argument, sometimes put forth by opponents of same-sex marriage or civil unions, that ministers will be forced to officiate them, is a complete red herring. That's never, ever been the case. So I turn the argument that Reverend Warren and others of his persuasion are making on same-sex marriage, I turn it around. This is my reply to it. What you are really saying is that in order for your position or belief as to what constitutes a valid marriage to be upheld as a matter of civil law, if that's going to be upheld, then the rights of same-sex couples to enter into marriage has to be denied by the state. That's a position I cannot tolerate. Moving beyond these two examples, moving now to a close, here's the distinction I make on this whole matter. To be respectful and tolerant of a wide range of beliefs, opinions, and attitudes, as I believe one should be, is not always and not necessarily the same as being tolerant of all the actions and outcomes that might flow from those beliefs or opinions. To cite what is probably the most obvious example, I can respect and tolerate the religious beliefs and the beliefs in God, however conceived, of practically anybody. But that certainly does not extend to tolerating acts of terrorism in the name of God or in the name of a particular religious faith. It is the point at which a set of beliefs or opinions becomes harmful, destructive, or detrimental to the common good and to the public good, that is when my tolerance runs out. And you don't really need to be a moral philosopher of any kind to figure that out. It's a fairly obvious point, I would think. I can show a true spirit of tolerance for a sincerely held belief and opinion that a person or a religious community holds for the basis of how they conduct their personal life or the life of their religious community. But I cast a very cautious eye when those beliefs and opinions are put forth as public policy. in a way that would be binding on an entire population. Well, finally then, I'm pleased to represent a faith tradition that was born out of a spirit of religious toleration. I would go on to say that a full embrace of this tradition also includes standing up to the many forms of intolerance we encounter, whatever name or rationale may be used for them. We are a community that practices respect and tolerance. And we are also a justice-loving community and a justice-seeking community. And it's how we hold these two very worthy principles in balance. That is one of the many positive challenges we face as we continue on in the life of our congregation.